The front never really moved. No phase of the American Indian Wars, beginning in the early 1600s, was remotely comparable. And now Mackenzie was being unchained and ordered to make it stop. The peace policy still applied to Indians who were on the reservation, and his 4th Cavalry, staging out of forts in central Texas, was still not allowed to cross the Red River to hunt hostiles. But there was to be death and scorched earth for those who insisted on remaining off the reservation. The problem was, as always, where to find them. In the spring of 1872, a solution presented itself. A captured Comanchero named Polonio Ortiz revealed the existence of a wagon road with plenty of water and grass that ran east to west across the Llano Estacado and into New Mexico. This was not only the legendary pass through the desiccated and impassable plains that white men had heard about but never found, it was also the road down which thousands of head of stolen cattle moved from Texas to New Mexico. This was the Comanchero cattle load, the source of guns and ammunition and food for the still wild Comanche bands. To discover it meant that they would not only disrupt the illegal cattle trade, they would also find Comanches. In July and August of 1872, under orders to break up the organized cattle raiding, Colonel Mackenzie and his 4th Cavalry conducted a series of remarkable, unprecedented explorations. Operating out of a base camp on the freshwater fork of the Brazos in Blanco Canyon, he first scouted northward along the caprock, crossing and recrossing from high to low plains, as the Quahadis had done. Using the Comanchero Ortiz as a scout, he crossed the southern fork of the Red River, known as the Prairie Dogtown Fork, and into the region of present-day Clarendon. He then turned south again, through jagged and harshly beautiful canyon lands, and along a route that passed through present-day Turkey, Matador, and Roaring Springs. He did not know it at the time, but this part of Texas, just west of present-day Amarillo, had become the main refuge and sanctuary of the wild Comanche bands. One can imagine how Mackenzie's troops looked, tiny figures in the monumental landscape of West Texas, riding week after week through the searing plains heat and the untracked immensity, their tack creaking and their regimental song on their lips. "Come home, John, don't stay long. Come home soon to your own Chickabiddy." The land was pristine, untouched. There was wildlife everywhere. Sandhill cranes rising by the tens of thousands from Playa Lakes, buffalo herds that filled the horizon. Mackenzie found no Indians there, nor the cattle trail, but his new understanding of the country, knowledge no white man had ever possessed, would figure heavily in the final battles. In late July, Ortiz and other scouts discovered a wide road leading onto the Llano Estacado, bearing evidence that large herds of cattle had recently traveled over it. Mackenzie followed the new trail. He was by this point obsessed with his task, which, as he conceived it, meant forcing the Comanche and Kiowa outliers onto the reservation. He slept lightly, if at all, staying up late into the night, studying scouting and other reports, and whatever maps he could get his hands on. He drilled his troops hard. They were already a vastly superior fighting unit than the one he had inherited, not least because of their schooling at Blanco Canyon. His personality was harsher and quirkier than ever. His Civil War wounds, several of which had never properly healed, caused him unceasing pain. Riding for long hours over rough terrain was excruciating. According to Robert G. Carter, who served under him for many years, it was this almost criminal neglect of his own health that accounted for a personality that had become irritable, irascible, exacting, sometimes erratic, and frequently explosive. To the white epithet Three Finger Jack was added the Comanche names Bad Hand and No Finger Chief. They were getting to know him. He had a hectoring, badgering sort of personality that would not leave anything or anyone alone. He was hard on everyone around him, harsh in his assessments, and almost never generous with praise. That included his reports to his superiors. His reticence to talk about what he had done guaranteed him and his men an obscure place in American history. Mackenzie was not without his good points. He was scrupulously fair and quick to correct an injustice. He never played favorites and would not tolerate servility or self-seeking. In the next month, he crossed the Llano Estacado twice, by different routes, navigating an area that had never been penetrated by the army. Carson's trip from New Mexico to Adobe Walls had followed the Canadian River, much farther north. On his return trip, which traced a route roughly from today's Tucumcari to today's canyon, just south of Amarillo, he made a brilliant discovery: a plain-spanning trail with access to permanent, high-quality water sources at points no more than 30 miles distant from each other. It was just as Ortiz had predicted. Though Mackenzie had not seen any Indians or cattle, in such enormous spaces the chance had been small anyway, he had penetrated the great mystery of the Llano Estacado, the undiscovered country at the heart of Comancheria. By the end of the trip, the 4th Cavalry knew all about the weird and quirky world of the High Plains, its vicious thunderstorms, killer ant colonies, unruly pack mules, and raging wildfires. They learned how to use buffalo dung as fuel, and how to find water and navigate through immense flatness. Mackenzie, wrote Wallace, had made a highly significant contribution to the exploration and opening of the great American West. He had found two routes across the treacherous plains. The discovery of the roads and the good water would make it possible to keep the hostile Indians constantly on the run until they would surrender, or all be surprised and captured, or killed. He thought nothing of this accomplishment. He still had work to do. He had heard from the same Comanchero that Cotsurica chief Shaking Hands Band was camped on the North Fork of the Red River. On September 21, 1872, he turned north. With 222 soldiers and 9 Tonkawa scouts, he marched toward the rolling, broken prairie on the eastern slope of the Caprock Escarpment. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon of September 29th, Mackenzie's force, riding in 4-column echelon, galloped into the middle of a Comanche village of 175 large teepees and 87 small ones on the North Fork, about 5 miles from the present town of Lafours. Taken completely by surprise, the Comanches could do little more than run and hide from the bluecoats and their guns. Many died within the first few minutes of battle. 80 or more of them were cut off and cornered in a ravine. They charged the white battle line several times, and each time were repulsed at great cost. The fight quickly became something more like a shooting gallery. One of Mackenzie's officers, W.A. Thompson, compared it to a troop of men in line on a stage, firing into a crowded theater pit. Many of the Indians ended up in a pool made by a brook that ran through the middle of the camp. Some were there hiding beneath overhanging grass. Most were dead. So many were killed and wounded in the water that it was red from hole to hole with blood, wrote a white captive named Clinton Smith, who fought with the Indians. Many Comanches escaped into the brush of the river bottom. As Mackenzie noted tersely in his report, the battle was over in half an hour. He had to forcibly restrain his Tonkawas from scalping all the dead Comanches. When the smoke from the black powder had cleared, he had killed 52 Indians and had lost only 4 of his own. He had taken 124 prisoners, mostly women and children, something that had not happened to Comanches within anyone's memory. It had very likely never happened. Not at least since the advent of the horse. Just as important, he had captured 3,000 horses, which meant that he had very likely put on foot a good many of those who had escaped. How many got away is not known, just as it is not known how many were in the camp when the Bluecoats attacked. The rule was 8 to 10 people and 2 fighting men per large teepee. If that was true, then a huge percentage of what was left of the Comanches, including reservation Indians, had been camped with Shaking Hand. It would later be learned that members of all 5 major bands were there, though at the time of the battle, Shaking Hand, ironically, was on a train to Washington to meet the Great Father and discuss peace. Just downriver, moreover, was another camp of mostly Quahadis, so close that they could hear the shooting. In Mackenzie's official report, he noted without elaboration that the lodges were generally burned and a large amount of other property was destroyed. There would, in any case, be nothing left for the Indians to use. In historical terms, Mackenzie's victory was stunning. He had achieved it by daring to go where white men had not gone, by using his Indian scouts well, and then by attacking in force the moment he had intelligence of the camp. He had attacked with fury. Unlike Chivington's drunken thugs, though, they also knew restraint. They had been under orders to try to avoid killing women, children, and old men. Mackenzie was unusually attentive to this, for a Western officer, but as he himself noted, many of the people in those categories were too badly wounded to be moved. And the Tonks had done plenty of damage before he could rein them in. The other side, predictably, had a somewhat different account. In the version given by Captive Herman Lehman, who was with the Comanches at the time, he wrote, "We arrived the next day after the fight and found the dead bodies scattered about. I remember finding the body of Batsina, a very brave warrior, lying mutilated and scalped, and alongside of him was the horribly mangled remains of his daughter, Nuki, a beautiful Indian maiden who had been disemboweled and scalped. The bodies presented a revolting sight. Other bodies were mutilated too, which showed the hand of the Tonkaway in the battle." Mackenzie had achieved what Plains Indians valued more than anything, surprise. He was learning from them to exploit weakness. That night, he took pains to place his captives inside a well-guarded circle of supply wagons. They were amazingly representative of the larger tribe. There were 34 Kotsorikas, 30 Quahadis, 18 Yamparikas, 11 Nokonis, and 9 Panaticas, showing just how fluid the exchange between reservation and the wild Comanches really was, and suggesting that the old band structures were dissolving. One or possibly two of the Quahadis were wives of Quanah. He ordered the pony herd to be taken a mile away from the burned village and placed the horses under the guard of one of his lieutenants and the Tonkawas. Incredibly, Mackenzie, so roughly schooled in Comanche horse culture, had made another mistake. He still did not understand Comanches and horses, or the fact that a handful of Tonks were still no match for Comanche riders. After dark, the Comanches made short work of it, stampeding the horses and not only getting most of their own back, but also those of the Tonkawas, who arrived in the main camp the next day, looking sheepish and unhappy, leading a small burro. The following night, when the command made another camp 18 miles distant, the Comanches took back most of the horses that were left. All that remained of the remuda were 50 horses and 9 mules. Mackenzie was furious. He would never again make the mistake of believing he could hang on to Comanche horses. According to his sergeant John Charlton, no effort after that was ever made to hold a herd of wild captured Indian ponies. They were all shot. For the people, the Battle of the North Fork of the Red River, sometimes called the Battle of McClellan Creek, was a shattering experience. Nothing like this had happened to them before, and the depth of their grief was startling. They were inconsolable. Wrote former captive Clinton Smith, who was with the tribe, "Every night for a long time, I could hear the old squaws crying away out from the camp, mourning for their dead. They would gash themselves with knives, and when they returned to the camp, their faces and arms and breasts showed signs of the mutilation which they underwent in their agony." The worst of it was their utter powerlessness to get the captives back. The Comanches, famous for their arrogance, were abject and helpless in their grief. This was amply shown a few weeks later when Bull Bear, the chief of the wild, unbowed Quahadis, and the only chief who had never signed a treaty or reported to the agency, humbly brought his band to the vicinity of Fort Sill to beg for the release of the women and children. He told Agent Lowry Tatum, known to him as Bald Head, that he had lost the fight with the soldiers, accepted his final defeat, and was now ready for peace. He would come into the reservation, put his children in the white man's school, and become a farmer as long as he got his women and children back. Bull Bear was lying. His views on the subject were well known. He believed in fighting to the death. But at the moment, he just wanted his people released. Over the next few months, that is what happened. And in June 1873, 116 women and children and a few old men were brought back from their imprisonment at Fort Concho to Fort Sill and returned to freedom. The release did not resolve anything. Soon large numbers of Comanches, including Bull Bear and his Quahadis, were back in their old camps, doing what they had always done. That year they got a reprieve. Mackenzie, who was ready to mount a final campaign against them, was sent instead to the Mexican borderlands to stop the cross-border raiding of Texas settlements by Kickapoos and Apaches. Years of protests to the Mexican government had brought no change. Acting on unofficial orders from Sheridan, Mackenzie and his 4th Cavalry crossed 80 miles into Mexico in violation of every conceivable international treaty and destroyed 3 Kickapoo Apache settlements. His attack caused an international furor, and he maintained all along the fiction that he had taken the action on his own authority. When one of his men then asked what Mackenzie would have done if he had refused to cross the border, the colonel answered, "I would have had you shot." When he returned in August, he had a violent attack of rheumatism that kept him out of the field until January 1874. It meant that the Comanche problem would have to wait another year. 18. The Hyde Men and the Messiah. But something even worse than the No Finger Chief haunted the Comanche nation in the cruel spring of 1874. They were losing their identity. In the long years of their ascendancy, they had always been a people apart, fiercely independent, arrogantly certain that their pragmatic, stripped-down Spartan ethic was the best way to live. Unlike the Romans, who borrowed everything from clothing to art, food, and religion from cultures around them, the Comanches were aggressively parochial. They were the world's best horsemen and the unchallenged military masters of the South Plains. They did not need elaborate religious rituals or complex social hierarchies. They kept their own counsel. Now, in ways startlingly reminiscent of what happened to the miserable Penaticas, all that was changing. It began with the bands themselves. Once the main social units of the tribe and the principal source of tribal identity, they were disintegrating, losing their boundaries, merging with other remnants. The captives taken by Mackenzie from what was nominally a Kutsotika camp represented all 5 major bands, a level of tribal intermingling that would have been unimaginable even 10 years before. This partly had to do with sheer numbers. Where once thousands upon thousands of Comanches in single, unified bands lived in camps that wound for miles along the Brazos or Canadian or Cimarron rivers, now groups with blurred affiliations, numbering only in the hundreds, huddled together against the harsh emptiness of the plains. The quirks of language, customs, and folkways that had made each band distinct were vanishing. Quahadi culture and vernacular, in fact, had begun to dominate. The end of the bands meant a scarcity of war chiefs and peace chiefs. Increasingly, there were no followers to lead. There was also the relentless push of the invading culture. Like all Indians before them, the people were being submerged in a sea of the white man's material goods. This was true even of the Quahadis, who had held themselves aloof and apart longer than any others. Where once the tribe lived in the purity of the buffalo and all that it provided, now there were the Taibo's weapons and cooking tools and sheet metal, his sugar and coffee and whiskey, his clothing and calico. They used his blankets. They ate food boiled in his brass kettles. At the agency, they waited quietly to be given his rancid meat, rotten tobacco, and moldy flour. But it wasn't just the white man's civilization that was corrupting the old Numenu. They had also begun to adopt the customs of other tribes. There were many examples of this cultural jostling to which they were increasingly vulnerable. Their traditional headgear, for example, had been the fearsome, unornamented black buffalo wool cap with jutting horns, the stuff of nightmares for generations of settlers. Now, most of them had taken to wearing the more delicate, streaming feathered headdress of the Cheyennes. Quanah was among those who had adopted this style. Comanche burial had been, like so much else in the culture, a simple and practical affair. The body would be carried off to a natural cave, a crevice, or a deep wash, and covered with rocks or sticks, in no particular arrangement. Now the tribe was adopting the more elaborate, raised scaffold biers of the northern tribes. Soon they would even steal the Kiowa's sun dance. They had witnessed the ceremony for decades, without caring much about what it was. Now they were less sure that they did not need it. At the core of their identity, of course, they were hunters and warriors, precisely what the white man wanted to deny them. While the Great Father and his apostles had not yet succeeded in this righteous mission, the thousand or so Comanches who took food and annuities at Fort Sill had already lost their identity as hunters. The men saw this as a form of slavery. What stories could they tell their children or grandchildren if all they did was wait at the reservation to be given food? Or worse still, became farmers. The greatest threat of all to their identity, and to the very idea of a nomadic hunter in North America, appeared on the plains in the late 1860s. These were the buffalo men. Between 1868 and 1881, they would kill 31 million buffalo, stripping the plains almost entirely of the huge lumbering creatures, and destroying any last hope that any horse tribe could ever be restored to its traditional life. There was no such thing as a horse Indian without a buffalo herd. Such an Indian had no identity at all. The first large-scale slaughter of buffalo by white men with high-powered rifles took place in the years 1871 and 1872. There had been a limited market for buffalo products before that. Even as far back as 1825, several hundred thousand Indian-tanned robes had made it to markets in New Orleans. There had been demand for buffalo meat to feed the railway workers building the Transcontinental Railroad in the 1860s, spawning the fame and legend of hunters like Buffalo Bill Cody. But there was no real market for buffalo hides until 1870, when a new tanning technology allowed them to be turned into high-grade leather. That, combined with a new railhead in Dodge City, Kansas, meant that the skins could be shipped commercially. For hunters, the economics of the new business was miraculous, all the more so since the animals were so stupefyingly easy to kill. If a buffalo saw the animal next to it drop dead, it would not flee unless it could see the source of the danger. Thus, one shooter with a long-range rifle could drop an entire stand of the creatures without moving. A hunter named Tom Nixon once shot 120 animals in 40 minutes. In 1873, he killed 3,200 in 35 days, making Cody's once outlandish-sounding claim of killing 4,280 in 18 months seem paltry by comparison. Behind the hunters stood the stinking, sweating skinners, covered head to toe in blood and grease and the animal's parasites. Legendary hunter Brick Bond, who killed 250 animals a day, employed 15 such men. Covered wagons waited at adobe walls to take the stacked skins to Dodge City. Except for the tongues, which were salted and shipped as a delicacy, the carcasses were left to rot on the plains. The profits, like the mass killing itself, were obscene. In the winter of 1871-72, a single hide fetched $3.50. Within 2 years, these hunters, working mainly the Kansas plains close to Dodge City, had killed 5 million buffalo. Almost immediately, they were victims of their own success. By the spring of 1874, the herds on the Middle Plains had been decimated. The economics of hunting became a good deal less miraculous. As one scout traveling from Dodge City to the Indian Territory put it, "In 1872, we were never out of sight of the buffalo. In the following autumn, while traveling over the same district, the whole country was whitened with bleached and bleaching bones." Thus, the hunters were forced to move farther from the railheads in search of prey. So they went south to the Texas plains, where horizon-spanning herds still drifted across the sky-spanning landscape, where they appeared, as historian Francis Parkman observed in 1846, like the black shadow of a cloud passing rapidly over swell after swell of the distant plain. The problem was that the Texas Panhandle was 150 miles away from Dodge City, the only place set up to ship hides. To remedy that, and to give the hunters a place to sell their goods, in March 1874, a trading post was built near the Canadian River, only a mile from the adobe walls ruins where Kit Carson had battled Comanches a decade before. The place went by the same name. It consisted of two stores, a saloon, and a blacksmith shop. Except for the blacksmith shop, which was built of pickets, the buildings were wood-framed, sod-sided, and sod-roofed. The precise type of building materials would soon become extremely important. By June, the post was doing a brisk business. Hunters brought in tens of thousands of hides and traded for weapons, ammunition, flour, bacon, coffee, canned tomatoes, soup, dried apples, and syrup, and such sundries as wolf poison and axle grease. The money was beyond their wildest dreams of avarice. It flowed in buckets. The fortunes of Dodge revived, and the slaughter, which everyone knew would result in the extermination of the buffalo within a few years, continued apace. The hide men were, on the whole, a nasty lot. They were violent, alcoholic, illiterate, unkempt men who wore their hair long and never bathed. The skinners had body odors that defied the imagination. These plainsmen hated the Indians, and not just because they had brown skins. They believed that the Comanches and Kiowas raided and made war not because it was their traditional way, but so they could squeeze money and land out of the government. They believed that what the government paid the Indians amounted to blackmail. "They are a lazy, dirty, lousy, deceitful race," said hunter Emanuel Dubbs in 1874. "True manhood is unknown, and they hold their women in abject slavery." When they were not eradicating the helpless buffalo from the face of the earth, the hide men congregated in a set of western hell towns that had arisen to meet their primitive urges. Outside the 4th Cavalry outpost at Fort Griffin, for example, an instant town was put up known as the Flat. It consisted of flimsy, unpainted frame buildings made of lumber that had been hauled several hundred miles. There were sleazy hotels, dance halls, and saloons, prostitutes, gamblers, and card sharps. In one of the saloons, a red-haired poker queen named Lottie Dino held court. Her hired gunmen stood by to kill anyone who questioned her ethics. Surprisingly, only a few voices cried out against the slaughter of the buffalo, which had no precedent in human history. Mostly, people didn't trouble themselves about the consequences. It was simply capitalism working itself out, the exploitation of another natural resource. There was another, better explanation for the lack of protest, articulated best by General Phil Sheridan, then commander of the military division of the Missouri. "These men, hunters, have done in the last 2 years more to settle the vexed Indian question than the entire regular army has done in the last 30 years, he said. "They are destroying the Indians' commissary. For the sake of a lasting peace, let them kill, skin, and sell until the buffaloes are exterminated. Then your prairies can be covered with speckled cattle and the festive cowboy." Killing the Indians' food was not just an accident of commerce. It was a deliberate political act. The winter of 1873 to 74 had been a hard one for the people, many of whom were now shifting restlessly between the agency lands and the camps of the wild Comanches in West Texas. Those who stayed on the reservation were cruelly deceived. There was little game there, and no buffalo at all. As before, they were forced to live on the white man's rations. As before, much of this promised food simply never arrived, and what was given to them was often of shockingly inferior quality. Facing starvation, the Comanches were forced to kill their own horses and mules for food. These Indians were also victimized by an entirely new phenomenon. Organized gangs of white horse thieves, often dressed up as Indians, who preyed with impunity on the Comanche and Kiowa herds. They took the animals to Kansas and sold them. No one pursued them. No one prosecuted them. Cheating the Indians was always a good business. And while that was happening, white whiskey peddlers moved freely inside the reservation, illegally selling diluted rot-gut liquor in exchange for buffalo robes. It amounted to robbery. The liquor cost little to make, while selling robes was virtually the only way many Indians could make money. Whiskey was becoming a serious problem. Many of the Indians became quickly addicted and thus desperate to trade anything to get it. For those Comanches who still raided the borderlands, the winter of 1873-74 was even worse. Mackenzie kept patrols in the field at all times, and those patrols began to have a devastating effect on small raiding parties. In December, a group of 21 Comanches and 9 Kiowas rode south through Texas and crossed the Rio Grande into Mexico. It was a good old-fashioned raid and must have warmed their hearts. They killed and took captives and stole horses and suffered no casualties. Then they turned for home, and their luck ran out. At Kickapoo Springs, near present-day San Angelo, they and their string of 150 horses were intercepted by Lieutenant Charles Hudson and 41 troopers from Mackenzie's 4th Cavalry. A hot 10-minute fight ensued, in which 9 Comanches were killed, and Hudson suffered only one man wounded. The Comanches also lost 70 horses. A few weeks later, a 10th Cavalry patrol under Lieutenant Colonel George Buell engaged a Comanche raiding party near the Double Mountain Fork of the Brazos River, killing 11. 2 weeks later, another raiding party was attacked, and another 10 Indians killed. Though the absolute numbers were small, in the desperate waning years of Comancheria, these were major disasters. The people took the news hard, as did the Kiowas. Kiowa chief Lone Wolf lost his son and his nephew in the fight with Hudson. In his grief, Lone Wolf cut off his hair, killed his horses, and burned his wagon, lodge, and buffalo robes, and vowed revenge. He might have been gratified to know that Lieutenant Hudson died that winter too, killed accidentally by his roommate, who was cleaning a gun. Quanah, who also lost a nephew to Buell's men, would have a far more radical reaction, one that would eventually affect the fate of all Plains Indians. All of this was terrible news for the people. They went into deep mourning for their lost ones, and also, perhaps, for their own lost world. Then, when it did not seem as if things could get any worse, the buffalo hunters arrived in adobe walls and began to turn the panhandle into a stinking graveyard. These were frightening times, and there is no reason to believe that the last of the Comanches, defiant on the high plains, did not understand their historical position. They were almost alone now. Most of the Arapahos had given up. They had gone in. The Cheyennes were confused and leaderless. These were the southern bands of those two tribes. The Kiowas were riven by political quarrels, deeply split between the idea of surrendering and fighting to the end. There was no one else living outside the territories anymore, not on the South Plains. Just a few thousand Comanches who were watching their old world die and losing their identities in the process. Just at this point, when it seemed that all hope would soon be lost, there arose from the Comanche tribe a prophet. He was very young, but he had a great and towering vision. He had the answer to all of their ardent prayers. He was called Isatai, which was one of those Comanche names that delicate Western sensibilities had trouble translating. Sometimes it is given as rear end of a wolf, which is amusing but inaccurate. Elsewhere, it appears as coyote droppings, coyote anus, and wolf shit. But even these were euphemisms along the lines of buffalo hump. The more accurate translation would have been wolf's vulva or coyote vagina, both of which were unprintable until well into the 20th century. He was a medicine man, a magician, and probably a con man too, though there was no question that he believed at least some of what he was preaching. He was a Quahadi, probably around 23 years old, a stocky man with a large head, a broad open face, and a bull neck. In the winter and spring of 1873-74, Issa Tai had established himself as the possessor of an electrifying sort of puja that Comanches had never seen before. He claimed miraculous healing powers and the ability to raise the dead. Though he was as yet untested in battle, he maintained that the white man's bullets could have no effect on him, and that he could also make medicine that would make others immune, even if they stood directly before the muzzles of the white man's guns. These were impressive things, but not without precedent. Other shamans had claimed the same magic. That year, however, Issa Tai had, in the presence of witnesses, raised from his stomach a wagon load of cartridges, had belched it up, and had then swallowed it again. On four separate occasions, he had, again in front of witnesses, ascended into the skies, far beyond the sun, to the home of the Great Spirit, remaining there overnight and coming back the next day. Most astonishing of all, when a brilliant comet appeared in the sky, he had correctly predicted that it would disappear in 5 days. His legend spread throughout the plains. People said he could control the elements and send hail, lightning, and thunder against his enemies. How did he convince people he could do these things? Part of the answer may lie in his abilities as a magician. In one account, he was able to make arrows appear in his hands as though they had flown there out of the air. This sounds like the sort of sleight of hand that any competent modern magician could do. According to Quaker teacher Thomas Batty, who worked at the time on the Kiowa reservation, Issa Tai had a particular technique for creating the illusion that he was rising into the clouds. "He gathered people in a sacred spot," wrote Batty, "then tells them to look directly at the sun until he speaks to them, then to let their eyes slowly fall to the place where he is standing. As they do this, they will see dark bodies descend to receive him, with which he will ascend. He would then slip away and remain concealed until his return."
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.